Good afternoon, Peter. Welcome to us here at PGR Matters in the studio. It's fantastic to have you here today. I know that you've already been quite busy with supervisory meetings today as well. So very grateful for your time and also for sending over some fascinating information about your project. I normally start these conversations just by asking a little bit about our guests, what we tend to call the academic origin story. So where you've come from academically, what kind of courses you've come from, whether you came straight into a research degree. So do you want to tell listeners a little bit about your experience, where you came into your current research degree?
Well, of course. And thank you for asking me on the programme. It's very nice to be here. I think like a lot of people doing PhDs, certainly in this day and age, I've had quite a lot of life experience, as they call it, before coming here. I certainly didn't come straight out of university. And in fact, my background is quite unrelated in that I have a career in music, both as a performer and more lately as a music examiner. But my interest that brought me to this project was really my interest in maps, which is of long standing. When I was a child, I had my parents had a beach house, and I used to buy hydrographic office maps. This was in New Zealand, where I was born, and plot out imaginary voyages around the coastlines near their beach house. And I've still got those maps. Wow. And more latterly, I ended up buying antique maps, of which I now have all sorts of things. And they are fascinating. So historic maps really brought me into this sort of thing. And I thought they were so interesting that I did an MA in History of Art, looking at maps as artistic objects. Mm-hmm. And that's not necessarily the way people normally look at mapping. They think of cartography and geography, what is out there. This was looking more at how they were perceived as decorative items, as printed matter on a page. Mm. And when I was doing that, I was focusing on a particular atlas by this chap called Greenville Collins, who was a late 17th century naval officer. And it rapidly became apparent that there was a great deal more to him than was really available just in the one atlas that he produced. He did a lot of very interesting things at a very interesting time. The Navy in the late 17th century was a major British institution, the biggest institution in the country as far as expense was concerned. So that made me think there's a lot more to this, and I'd like to actually find out about this guy's life and work and what impact that had on the development of maps as the type of things that I'd been buying and would continue to buy from a later period. So looking around for where I might do some research and that sort of thing, I happened on UEA, which is comparatively near to home.
Excellent. Well, I mean, we're not far from the coast here, and the coastline features fairly prominently. Actually, I mean, you turn the news on, and we're talking about coastal erosion. We think about the kind of the place of East Anglia as a coastal community in many ways. We've got a huge number of villages. We've got these major towns, ports along the eastern side of the country. Many of those places, I guess their fortunes have changed over the years, or their industries have changed over the years.
Well, oddly enough, I was actually just this morning looking at one of Collins's drawings of coastal views, which are useful for navigation. And you say the futures of these villages have changed, and in many cases they particularly have, because in his atlas, printed in 1693, he had a nice little view of the town of Dunwich. Now, you can go out on the North Sea all you like now, but you're not going to see that view because there is no town of Dunwich there. It's all gone. And yet, this is only 300 and whatever years ago, but he still could draw a view of the town of Dunwich. But it shows those whole East Anglian coasts as dynamic environments. Yeah. The coast was very important to Collins. There's research going on here at UEA about the sinking of the Gloucester, which ran aground on sandbanks off the East Anglian coast in 1682, the same period as this guy was doing his mapping work. And those feature those features become important in the work of mapping when you have a situation where the landscape or the seascape is constantly changing. Your map is almost out of date the moment you've printed it. What do you then do? And it makes it a very interesting study about how you can interact with what is supposed to be a record of an environment when that environment is endlessly shifting.
So Collins is best known for his atlas, so it's Great Britain's coasting pilot. Can you explain the significance of this work and how, I guess, how it contributed to the professionalisation of this, the term you use in your research proposals, which you very kindly sent through, is this idea of naval hydrography. So maybe if we start with the naval hydrography as a thing, what do we mean by that?
Well, the naval part doesn't really matter. The hydrography part is really just a nice term that means watery maps. Cartography is the mapping of the land. Hydrography is simply the mapping of the water. Now, of course, you can't map water, but what you can map is what is underneath the water. If you go out and make a map, you know, outside the studio here, we can look at across the broad, we can see where the rises of the land are, where there are the depressions, we can make a map of that, it's all visible. You go out on the sea and you want to know what's likely to hit the bottom of your boat, but you can't see it because it's all hidden by water. That's what hydrography is. It's the blind measurement of land you can't see because it's underwater. That's really all that mattered. Now, in the 17th century, this was very much in its infancy. And as far as maps of the British coast were concerned, they were all, mostly anyway, made by the Dutch. Now, that's fine. The Dutch were in a very prosperous period in the 17th century, their golden age. They were clever. They made nice maps. The trouble is we spent most of the 17th century at war with them. And having to use maps of your own coastline that are made by your enemy can, you know, cause some complexities. So in the middle of the 17th century, the king, Charles II, decided that it was really about time that we had some maps of the British coast made by British people. So he commissioned Greenville Collins in 1681 to conduct a complete survey of the entire British coast, which this captain, being a brave chap, said, yes, of course I can do that. It'll take 7 years, which, you know, even then, 7 years is remarkably short time to map. I don't know what the actual length of the British coast is, but it's some thousands of miles. And so he set out in 1681 to chart the entire coastline of Britain. Now, he had a number of problems with this. The surveying season when you're out on the sea is basically the same as the summer, so notoriously short. That cuts half the year out for starters. You've also got to have somebody pay for it. And everybody knows that Charles II was always short of money, largely because he spent too much of it on his mistresses and on war. So getting money to pay for it was always a challenge. And he had no really accurate map of the land to work from. So if you're going to map the sea side of the coast, you want to at least know what the land side of the coast looks like. And Collins had a tremendous problem with that. He worked quite closely with Samuel Pepys, who was not only a famous diarist, but was very high up in the administration of the Navy. He was the equivalent of a sort of government defence minister today. And Collins once said to Samuel Pepys that in his view, the coasts of Britain were better actually mapped by a chap called John Speed about 100 years earlier than they were in their modern maps of the time. So he had a lot of work to do.
It's fascinating that you've got these many people looking back very long periods of time to get reliable examples. And I'm just wondering what seemed to be the cause of that. Were there just very big gaps in the historical record or the cartographic record, or were the maps that were being produced in some ways insufficient in that time period, that they didn't show the detail? Or
it's not necessarily that they were insufficient. There were two main reasons why maps tended to be used for far too long. They took an awfully long time to make, as I've just said, because this was all done by hand. There were no satellites. There was no sort of proper theodolite or anything. You were working with very basic materials. And the other problem with them was that most maps were not produced by government agencies, as they would be now. There was no equivalent of the UK Hydrographic Office or the Ordnance Survey. These things hadn't yet been set up. So maps were produced by private map makers, publishers, engravers. And their objective wasn't really whether the map was good, but whether it would sell. So if you've got a product that's selling perfectly well, you keep selling it. Yeah. There's no incentive to make it new or better. And in fact, Collins's Atlas, Great Britain's Coasting Pilot, was published in 1693. But the last issue of it was actually produced in 1792.
That's quite a long run.
99 years of a run. Now, we were just talking earlier about how the East Anglian coast changes all the time, and most coasts change to some extent. And certainly in 100 years, you know, how good is your map going to be? But people were still buying it, so the chart makers would still sell it.
Fascinating. So, with the biography that you're working on with Collins, what were some of the major challenges that he faced during his career? Obviously, he's got this very big undertaking. He's got this 7-year period to work on this, this coastal survey. Politically, financially, it's a tricky period in British history, from what I know of it. How did he navigate that? Forgive the pun, I suppose.
And how did he navigate it? Very good. Well, actually, he was really quite clever in this. And there are a number of interesting points you raised there. It was a tricky period in British history. We'd done away with the king only 50 years before. Charles I got his head cut off. In 1688, just a few years before Collins produced his atlas, we did away with the king again. James II got booted out. Charles II, as I said before, was always short of money and spent much of the time sort of secretly borrowing it from the French. So there were a lot of problems politically. There was instability. The economy was not anything to write home about. England was not a major power in European terms. The Dutch were much wealthier. The French were much wealthier because they were bigger. We were a bit of a sorry state. But we did also have some advantages, one of which was a quite free intellectual environment. This same period, the 1660s, was when the Royal Society was founded, just after the Restoration. Isaac Newton was doing his stuff about gravity. Samuel Pepys was doing his interesting things in all sorts of fields. People like Robert Hooke were conducting scientific experiments. There was a lot of intellectual freedom. And Collins rather tapped into a lot of that. He had a great interest in things. He wrote several journals, which he was required to do for his job. But in them, he fills up pages and pages with notes on his observations of places he went, things he saw. So he had an intellectual curiosity, and that helped him navigate a lot of these challenges. The main challenge that was always faced, as I said earlier, was money. It costs a lot. Even when you're a one-boat operation, you've still got to feed the people on that boat. You've still got to repair the boat after the winter storms. You've still got to actually have horses for surveying the land side. There are a lot of expenditure issues. And money was his constant problem. And this comes up in the archival material all the time. Endless pleas to be paid what he was promised. Now, that's a problem. There was also the constant possibility of war.
Yes.
You know, we've already fought three wars with the Dutch in the 1640s, 50s and 60s. There was always the possibility of another. They were our great maritime trading rival. So they expected to own the same seas that we expected to own. The French were always planning to invade England, or at least looking like they were. You know, this again made things gave an instability to the general nature of his work. And he was also working with, as I said earlier, very, very basic gear. Mm. So there were a lot of challenges. He had not enough time. Mm. He was trying to survey the entire coast in a few years. Now, it doesn't work like that. So a lot of it was sketchy. He had not enough people, only 20 on his boat. Now, that's not very many when half of them are required to actually sail the boat. So there were a lot of these problems, and yet what he produced was still elegant, attractive, modern for the time, certainly a vast improvement on the old Dutch maps from the late 16th century, which were, you know, not scientific in any way. They were just pictures, really. So what he actually achieved was remarkable, given the constraints he faced.
So, Peter, you mentioned a little bit there about the journals. So Collins is producing these observations of places, presumably, you know, events, people, things that are happening. Can you share a few insights into your research process? So actually working with the original texts. Mm. Have you found anything particularly striking? Has anything sort of jumps out at you that people haven't really looked at before, or maybe a different take on what's already known?
Yes, I mean, there are all sorts of interesting things come out of the journals. Collins was an interesting chap from an archival point of view because he wasn't necessarily terribly important. He wasn't commanding a fleet. He wasn't in command of a great warship. He was a mid-ranking officer. But all officers of the Navy were required to keep records. They still are. And it was another invention, really, of Samuel Pepys when he was Secretary to the Admiralty. He said all lieutenants, captains, and masters, which are navigating officers, and that's what Collins was, must keep a journal of their voyages and then present it to the Admiralty for appraisal afterwards. And we'll see, you know, what interesting things are recorded that we can use. But Collins went further than that because he was intellectually inquisitive and he was also quite well educated. We don't know a great deal about his education, but his father went to Oxford, his son went to Oxford. So he came from a sort of intellectual environment and he was educated in the classics. So when he went, for example, around the Mediterranean in the late 1670s, he filled his journal with pages of descriptions of places like Naples. Now, a lot of what he recorded was the sort of thing you'd expect, how many troops the King of Spain keeps there, what the size of the castles around the harbour is. But he'd also talk about the fashions, the food, the wine. And he went around the Mediterranean for 4 years in the 1670s on a number of vessels, making these sort of observations. He recorded the first record in English of the great Malaga earthquake of 1679. He arrived only about 3 or 4 days after the earthquake had destroyed much of Andalusia. He went to what were the ruins of Troy at the other end of the Mediterranean and recorded notes on whether they were Troy or whether they were something that came after Troy. So he did have a lot of these sort of matters of interest. And what he also records frequently is something that's a little bit unexpected, how healthy they all were. Now, we tend to think that people who go off to sea in a sailing boat all get scurvy and spend their time picking the weevils out of biscuits. And it wasn't like that. And that, I did find, was rather surprising. In 1680, Collins went to the Mediterranean in a boat called the Leopard. Now, it was slightly more important because amongst the people aboard, they had one of the illegitimate sons of Charles II, the Duke of Grafton, who was about 15 at the time and was being trained for the sea. He was going to be made an admiral. So maybe things were a little better. But it's remarkable how often they record stopping and filling up with fresh provisions, fresh vegetables, fresh fruit. It's surprising to find that things like the dreaded scurvy, you know, that, read any account of 18th century explorations in the South Pacific, for example. And we always think Captain Cook in the 1760s sort of found the cure for scurvy, but it was well known. They would take on limes and citruses in the Mediterranean ports because they knew that kept the crew healthy. And this was 100 years before Cook. Now, I wouldn't have expected that to be the case. I was slightly surprised to find this stuff coming out of the archives.
It reminds me of, while you were talking there, a quote that you mention in relation to your project, which was apparently from the Duke of Buckingham in 1672, who's reported to have said, "The undoubted interest of England is trade, since it's only that which can make us either rich or safe." Obviously, we started out talking about war to talk about conflict between nations. But it sounds as though Collins was picking up on what's available through different markets,
along
the coast. So what's come out of that in relation to trade then?
Well, another thing that was particularly interesting about this whole period from a naval perspective is that although we were at war with the Dutch in the first, second, third Dutch wars, the French were always just lurking below the horizon. From 1674, there was actually quite a long period of peace. And this was the period when Collins was doing most of his work. Now, maybe that's because there was more peace. There's the threat of war, yes, but they weren't actively engaged in it. But what it does mean is that when you get peace, you don't need such a big navy. Navies are expensive. So the problem for a lot of officers after 1674 was that they weren't really needed. So part of Collins's mapping project was also a way of providing himself with opportunities to stay in employment. He was quite canny in that regard. But also, when he was doing these trips around the Mediterranean, and again, this comes out all the time in his journals, he says things like, we set sail and we sailed to Cadiz, and there we found, and he lists six British warships convoying 38 merchantmen for England. And then he goes off somewhere else. We arrived in the port of Livorno in Italy. And there we found, and he lists another eight British warships convoying 15 ships to Smyrna or Scanderoon or whatever. And that the thing that comes out of all this is that throughout the 1670s and into the 1680s, most British naval activity was actually convoy protection of merchant ships trading in the Mediterranean. And we often think of the sort of Stuart period as one in which the colonies were starting to come out. You know, there were colonies in America. The early explorations of places like Australia were starting to happen. William Dampier and so on in the 1680s, first man to reach Australia. So we tend to think that those overseas sort of seeds of empire were the important thing that was going on, but it wasn't. Trade with the Mediterranean was absolutely central to British prosperity. And most of the time, the Navy was busy shuttling back and forth, which is why officers like Collins enjoyed it so much, probably, all the way right up to the far end of the Mediterranean at places like Smyrna, which was a major port. And of course, a merchant ship convoy could carry a lot more trade than a camel train. So if the rich produce of the Orient all arrived in the eastern end of the Mediterranean, it was much easier to bung it on a ship, bypassing places like Venice that used to keep a stranglehold on these sort of luxury goods trades, and take it straight back to Britain. And that's not really something that we tend to think was important, but it was hugely significant.
It sounds as though Collins is a kind of, maybe not the heart of, but is very well plugged into these networks of influential people, writers, intellectuals. You mentioned the Royal Society earlier. What I mean, just as a sort of an extension of that, sort of developing that point, do you think there's some value in understanding these networks better through Collins? Obviously, this is a period where other people have written about. We've had a lot of people write about Samuel Pepys and many other figures. And also the kind of scientific revolution, I suppose, in terms of the development of...
Well, it's amazing how much crossover there was between them. You know, naval officers were frequently interested in science. They were frequently interested in the arts. Artistic people were often interested in the sciences. So... as I said earlier, it was a very active intellectual environment. London was a major centre for a lot of this sort of intellectual endeavour in the late 17th century. The Royal Society was certainly a central part of that, but it wasn't the only part. Mm. There was the foundation of things like Gresham College, which is still going. It was a sort of attempt to found a university in London that never quite became a university, but it employed professors to give lectures, and it still does even in today's states. So Collins was very much plugged in to these sort of networks. And you mentioned that Pepys was like this, and Pepys knew all sorts of people. But Pepys had a slightly higher social status. He was cousin of the Earl of Sandwich. And he did actually have some sort of wealth behind him. Collins was of a rather lower status, I suppose you could say. And yet, he's still associated with people like figures in the Royal Society. He had a very interesting experience mapping a cave in Bristol. And the results of this cave mapping exercise were published by Sir Robert Southwell in the Transactions of the Royal Society, with Collins's name in there and as the explorer and so on. And this turns out to be the first survey of a natural cave ever published.
Wow.
Now, these sort of things do come out of the woodwork with surprising frequency, that it's not something you'd expect at all. And yet there was this range of activities that people were engaged in and were interested in. It might have just been that the pace of life was a little slower than we do now. You know, we're all specialists in some minute field of endeavour. The idea of a broad understanding, a broad concept of knowledge, isn't quite as valued perhaps now as it might have been then.
Well, it's interesting, you're starting to talk about, I guess, how we think about the nature of knowledge, epistemology today. How do you see the impact of Collins' work on modern hydrography? So
hydrography.
Yeah, that's a very different thing. Modern hydrography. Well, so what?
Oddly enough, I don't really think there was very much influence on it. Collins was a seminal figure. He started things going. As far as maps and hydrography are concerned, when he published his atlas in 1693, the British more or less said, oh, we've got a nice atlas now, that's all we need to do. And they didn't bother doing anything else. Meanwhile, the French were busy having their French Enlightenment and doing things in a very complicated French way, but they stole the march on us. And throughout the 18th century, cartography and hydrography were basically dominated by the French. They founded their Dépôt de la Marine, the French equivalent of the Hydrographic Office, in the middle of the 18th century. I can't remember the date, 1760-something. We founded the Hydrographic Office here in 1795. So we were well behind the French. And yet throughout that whole period, we were still just navigating around the coasts with Collins's old atlas. So, you know, it did serve a purpose, and it filled that job very well. There are references right up to the end of the 18th, even into the early 19th century, where merchant mariners would particularly say, you know, of such and such, see Collins. And this crops up in journals quite frequently. Much beyond the time when we would think that those maps were out of date. So the Hydrographic Office that was founded in 1795 finally grasped the nettle and sort of took back the initiative from the French. And in the 19th century, of course, the Admiralty chart became the benchmark for quality. And I think, you know, even in the 21st century, when we have everything on a computer screen, there is still a need for printed maps, and they are still produced. And British Hydrographic Office charts are still considered the pinnacle of that sort of activity. So Collins didn't necessarily leave an enormous legacy personally, but he set the ball rolling for British map making to be something that we're supposed to be able to be proud of, which we should be.
The period that Collins's work is being carried out, obviously there's a lot of national concern about security at that point in time.
Yeah.
One of the things that you've sort of highlighted in your the outline of your research is this idea of the island nation. Mm. So once you start to actually spend time going around the coast, and you see the country in its entirety, or the collection of islands, I guess, in its entirety, you have a different conceptualization of that place and its people, rather in, I guess, in the way that, you know, we might think back to the late 1960s, early 1970s, about the, you know, the Earthrise photograph, that went sort of global from the moon to have a look back.
Yes, at the pale blue dot.
It seemed to change the way people thought about the world, about the kind of humanity, basically, in its future. Was there a kind of a shift in consciousness, I guess, or the way that people were thinking about the about Britain?
Yes, there was.
The idea of Britain.
Yes, well, the very concept of the idea of Britain was new. And the interesting thing here is the title of Collins's atlas. It's Great Britain's Coasting Pilot. Mm. To us, that just seems like what you call a map of the country. Mm. But the whole idea of Great Britain as an entity was entirely new. The previous attempt to make a British hydrographic atlas was called the English Pilot. Mm. And that change from English to British was something that was very much at the fore of thinking at the time. Britain as a concept didn't yet exist politically. Mm. After all, the Act of Union that made the Scottish and English parliaments one didn't occur until the reign of Queen Anne. Mm. Although the crowns had been unified under James I in 1603, politically, Scotland and England were still two separate nations. Mm. So Collins making his atlas as Great Britain's coasting pilot was quite a new idea. Mm. And it did start, well, I'm not sure that this necessarily meant it started something, but it was part of that idea of developing a national identity that meant essentially we could stop fighting each other and start properly fighting the French, which is what really happened. Prior to that, we had been constantly just fighting the Scottish, and before that we'd been busy suppressing the Welsh, and all the time we were busy suppressing the Irish. After the end of the 17th century, the focus of British endeavour was basically to fight the French.
So it shifts outwards. Yeah, from
we start looking outwards. And that goes at the same time that we start saying there's more to trade than just taking salt to the Mediterranean and bringing back silks. We can go globally on this. And this is why in the 18th century, following on from Collins's period, the growth of the navy was absolutely enormous, leading eventually to the sea-based empire. Mm. And although we tend to think, the British Empire, well, it's a bad thing these days, but actually, in the early days, it was basically a loose trading organisation. The empire was sea lanes connecting individual points. Mm. It wasn't necessarily about owning all of Canada or controlling all of India. That came rather later in the 19th century. But having
it's more about a sort
having
of a network.
Points along the coasts of those places was where the empire started, and that was all sea-based, and that's what Collins was starting to express with this idea of Great Britain as a unit, as an entity.
Mm. So, just to I guess shift a little bit from the away from the history Collins' his achievements and the kind of political context to think a little bit more about the your project actually and what you're doing in your research, because this is an interesting thing. When I was reading it, I'm kind of familiar with creative nonfiction. You've described this as an academic literary biography. What was behind your decision to approach the work in this way? So through sort of literature, drama, and creative writing, as opposed to say doing a historical critical study of this individual or this particular time period.
Well, To some extent, this is a historical critical study of this chap and his time. This could have been done in the School of History just as easily as in LDC. But really, my object was, to put it in very blunt terms, to write a book that was readable. And, no, I don't want to put my head on the block, but it has to be said that not all academic texts make for enjoyable reading.
That's probably true.
That's probably true. And you could write this as a perfectly good academic monograph. But I think there is more to it than that, because underlying all of these historical narratives is a story. It is a narrative. So if you're going to tell a story, my view was that you should tell it like a story. Now, that doesn't mean it can't be fully informed academically and it can't have a proper critical underpinning. But it's interesting enough that it becomes a story as well. So what I'm trying to do is make an amalgam between archival research and a ripping yarn. Now, I don't know how possible that is, but this is an attempt to do it. And we were all inspired by certain books, but a couple of books that particularly inspired me, one of which stood out when I first read it as a sort of the pinnacle of an example of what I'd like to do, was a book by Mary Hollingsworth called The Cardinal's Hat.
Oh, yeah, I've read it.
And yes. I can't remember when it came out, 2000, 2005, like that. It was based entirely on an enormous trove of archives, letters, and account books that were lurking in the state archives in Modena in Italy about the household of a Renaissance archbishop, Ippolito d'Este, as you'll remember. Now, he's only remembered for building the magnificent Villa d'Este in Rome, but prior to that, which he did at the end of his life, he had a whole career. No, he was made Archbishop of Milan at the age of 9, like you do. And he was a Renaissance prince, and he kept these magnificent accounts. Now, she found these accounts in this archive, I don't know how, and turned it into a story. But when you read the story, you know, the scholarship is phenomenal, but the story is what stands out. It's an absolutely gripping tale of ordinary people supporting an extraordinary man. And that's not something that you get just out of an economic monograph on those account books. That would be quite a different read altogether. So what I'm trying to do is humanize the figures of the Navy. We don't know what Collins looked like. We have his handwriting, but we know very little about him. But we can paint a different kind of picture out of what he did and how he did it and what the reactions to it were and how the results looked. So that sort of amalgam between, as it were, art and science was what led me to the idea of the literary academic biography. It should be fully footnoted. There should be a justification for every statement made. The sources need to be critically assessed. But the whole thing needs to be presented in a way that's going to keep the reader turning the pages. Now, I don't think that's an impossible balance to achieve.
It's an exciting one. I mean, it's a very...
Well, hopefully.
It definitely, I mean, certainly from, you know, this conversation, what you've been describing with Collins' life, his achievements, the people that he was connected to, the circumstances, a lot of those, I guess, you've kind of developed a bit of a dramatis personae of the period. So and he's one of these players. He's also got this tremendous challenge, I guess, in his career. You know, he's got 7 years to work on this survey. I think any good story, the main character, or in this case, you know, the hero of the story, or the protagonist that you're dealing with, I guess, is going to face some kind of momentous challenge, some kind of thing that's going to drive them forward. And I guess we've seen that a lot in, I'm just trying to think of kind of modern interpretations of this. We've tended to look at sort of scientists in the 20th century, you know, Oppenheimer and others. And we've elevated that to a kind of a very, you know, in this case, in Oppenheimer's case, a very troubled biography, but we've elevated those stories, which are actually about modern history. They're about these significant changes, these networks, these changes in the way that we view the world and we think about the world, and there being humans in that. It's not just a series of events that happen in world history that we do not have some kind of agency or agent in.
The idea that history is something that happens to other people.
Exactly.
It's not like that. Yeah. And when you look at what was going on in the late 17th century in England and look at the political turmoil and then look at the political turmoil that we're facing today, the parallels are obvious. And as I always say, if you don't learn from your history, you're condemned to repeat it. And I think, unfortunately, you know, we've had a lot of senior political figures in Britain in recent years that didn't learn from their history, so we repeated it. And what do we get? Chaos and upheaval.
Peter, it's been a pleasure listening to you talk about the project. I know you're only part of the way through. You've still got work to do. And it will, take, I'm sure, and it will occupy a lot of your life. And I hope an enjoyable experience as well, because not only have you talked about things that have sort of stood out so far in your work, but no doubt you'll find other things as you progress with the project. And so it'll be great to learn more about that in the future. Many of the things that you've talked about, we will be putting on the show notes today. So if people need to find a bit more about Collins himself, there's a Dictionary of National Biography entry, isn't there? So so we'll put those online. Mary Hollingsworth's book is a really fascinating read, as you say, and we'll put a link to that on there as well. But are there other resources, things that you think people should go and, you know, have a look at, maybe to get them into, maybe naval history, maybe cartography, maybe hydrography, anything that you think would be a good starting point?
Well, one of the things I would always recommend anybody who's anywhere near the south of England to do is go and visit the National Maritime Museum in Greenwich. It's free for starters, and it's absolutely fascinating. And you know, we do sometimes rather think, oh, another dusty museum. But they've managed at that. I was there not long ago. They've managed a really good amalgam at Greenwich between the sort of family-friendly, make it all hands-on for the kids, and the actual display of stuff that entertains and informs adults. And it was heaving with people, of course, but that is a good sign. So I'd recommend anybody who's anywhere near Greenwich, go and look at the river, because that's where these ships went up and down. That was where everything was centred, on the River Thames. And while you're there, pop into the National Maritime Museum. It is so worthwhile.
Great, thank you. Yeah, it's a fantastic institution. And I think you've given us a whole kind of extra dimension to appreciate this, to appreciate maritime history and the development of kind of naval mapping projects. So thank you very much, Peter. Great to have you on the show, and best of luck with your future
project. Thank you very much for having me. It's been fascinating.
Thank you. Bye.